Hey, this is Jay Young with King Operating. Have you ever considered paying less money in taxes? Would you like to do what the wealthy do and invest in oil and gas? Go on our website, kingoperating.com, and get my book about our model, ADD, Acquire, Develop, and Divest, or call our number 214-420-3000 to talk to somebody today about investing in oil and gas and saving money on your taxes.
The Jay Young Show is a weekly podcast featuring insightful discussions with anyone from big business CEOs, celebrities, to military heroes. Each interview is a personal conversation about business, life, and anything in between. And now, your host, Jay Young.
Hey, everybody. It's Jay Young. Jay Young Show today. We're going to have some great guests. We're going to talk about a little bit of entrepreneurship. We're going to talk about what it costs and how do you get into a fund. And what kind of fund is there out there that you can invest in? And how does that whole thing work? You know, long time for, you know, I didn't know really exactly when you invest in one of these funds, how does it work? I mean, so I give you money and you put in a fund and then where does the money go? How does it operate? What are you investing in? So we have somebody that, two people actually we want to welcome today. Christian Mack, Dennis Murchison. Welcome to the Jay Young Show.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jay.
Absolutely.
Glad to be here.
Glad you both are here, and we're going to learn a lot today. You know, and obviously, my focus is to help younger people, high school, college, watch the program, you know, and learn from people like this that are entrepreneurs, that have made money in their life, and learn from their mistakes, right? That's what we always learn, you know, as my dad always told me, you know, hey, don't do the same thing that I did over and over again. You know, the insanity clause, you know, learn some things new. So what I want to do now is I want to turn to these guys and I want to ask their backgrounds first. And then we're going to get into the fund and some of the things that they've done, you know, for their fund and how they invest and just kind of some things that you it may take you years and years to learn like it did me. So I want to dig down into that. But first, Christian, tell me about yourself. Where'd you grow up?
So that's an interesting story. My father is a foreign and local Lutheran missionary. And so his job was every 2 years, he would move throughout the United States and then in Australia for about 4 years and effectively set up churches. And so he would kind of go into an area, he would set up a church. Once that church had a certain following, usually between 30 and 50 people, he would move on to set up the next church. He's still doing that today. He's in Southern California. And my mom is a retired home ec teacher. So I basically graduated high school in 94 out of Florida, and then I actually moved to Chicago at that point, got into University of Chicago as a math major, put myself through school by taking on the IT job. So I consider myself from Chicago mostly. And then once after graduating in 98, because I like to joke around, I could spell IT back when everyone was worried about, you know, Y2K and the upcoming apocalypse. I basically was a IT consultant for a couple of years. Okay. And then figured that billable time was great, but there was only so much billable time of the day. Then I started a software company called Resolve Systems back in 99 that ultimately sold to a private equity company called Insight Partners. And that started my ability to create a family office, in which case that's when I met Dennis. And then in 2014, started a private equity fund called Lotus, and we've been doing that ever since.
Okay, great. So any brothers and sisters?
I do. Younger sister, four years younger. She is currently getting her PhD.
Oh, wow.
She lives in Austin. So
your name is Christian, Lutheran,
yep.
Minister, father. What's her name?
Christy.
Okay. I knew there was something. It had to be something in there. So interesting. Okay, so you know, you went through school, and what did you go to? Did you get a BBA or did you get a
Bachelor of Science?
You got a Bachelor of Science. Okay, that's the only education.
Yep.
Then after that, you went to work for the IT place, and then graduated from there later on, and then built a company that sold to a private equity company.
That's right. Yeah, okay. I started from scratch, actually in the basement of my house, and at one point was a 4-bedroom, 2.5-bath house. We had 13 people living in it.
Oh, my goodness.
So didn't really know it was going to take off in such a way, but we did it all through organic growth and basically told a bunch of people that couldn't necessarily afford to pay them all that much, but could give them room and board while we figured it out.
Wow.
So that was December 99.
December 99. Mm-hmm. Wow, it seemed like just a short time ago. And I know you've done extremely well since then and selling. When did you sell?
2012.
So 12 years. So you 12, 13 years to go through that whole entire. What was it like in the very beginning?
It was tough. I mean, it was kind of graduated from the School of Hard Knocks, got my, you know, MBA, my JD degree effectively through learning a whole bunch of, you know, best practices the hard way. But but it was exciting. It was very exciting, working around the clock.
So were you selling? What were you selling?
So we basically ultimately developed a software that effectively automated a lot of IT processes. So for instance, before back in the late 90s, early 2000s, people would call in about their cable issue. You know, something was going wrong with their cable, and you would have to talk to a level one engineer and then ultimately a level two engineer, level three engineer. Our software automated that process. So it identified the caller ID information, reconciled it with the account number, would actually do a lot of testing with it, and automated a lot of that process. And it was applicable to not just the telecommunications world, but also financial services, and then also the Department of Defense.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah.
So this is all your brainchild?
No. There's a lot of much smarter people than I was, but it effectively started with me, and then I partnered up with a hired number of people on the team, and actually relocated to Southern California in 2006, which is when we made an acquisition of a IP software that really helped us to, you know, kind of take it to the next level, take the start of the first company to the next level.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Good. That's good. So then you sold in 2012. Then you started a family office with your own money, and then you started to do this other fund that you're talking about that you want to talk about a little bit later on.
Yeah. So started in 2012, started to understand what a family office was, which at the end of the day is basically an organ, you know, setting up your own business to invest, you know, the proceeds of money that you've come into through a successful exit or something like that.
Right.
And learned kind of how that all worked and started to network with a number of individuals around, you know, what are the best practices for a family office. And that's actually when I met Dennis. Mm-hmm. And we kind of met at a dinner party once and started talking about, you know, the pros and cons of a family office and all these things. And as we kind of went and diversified, you know, and invested, you know, the proceeds of the sale, you know, ran into a number of different funds that were out there and started to realize that there's a lot of interesting funds that were very focused on, you know, pre-revenue types of companies that, in my opinion, were fairly risky, you know, types of investments. And I used to joke around with some of the family offices because they would, especially as I relocated to Southern California, one of the things that they mentioned to me was that every time they would run across a technology deal, they would send it my way just to check it out. Mm. And what I noticed was that there was a lot of investments that were in the technology realm that quite frankly were very risky. And I would joke around with people saying that you probably have better odds at Vegas than you would actually getting your money back through this investment. And so I started working with a number of people in my first company and started coming up with this investment thesis around identifying companies that really, you know, had great technology, but for some reason had stubbed their toe along their way, right? Because we had learned a lot of lessons, you know, as we started out from nothing. We never took on any kind of investment capital and then ultimately sold. So there were a lot of lessons learned in that 13, you know, which seems a very short journey, but was actually quite a bit longer than I initially anticipated. But ultimately speaking, kind of taking all those best practices and basically saying, hey, let's identify these companies that have really great technology that just really need these best practices to be applied, you know, these blueprints to be applied, both from a back office perspective, like finance, IT, HR, as well as on the front office, marketing, sales, and business development, so that we can kind of take these companies to the next level, you know, with the right leadership and in the right blueprint.
Okay. All right, great. All right, so that's great, Christian. So Dennis, tell me something about yourself. Where'd you grow up?
California, third generation California, but family from Dallas. Grandfather was Clint Murchison Sr., his brother, and then came out to California and was a stockbroker, investment banker, and had an affinity for broadcast. So he built a news radio station called KPOL, and it was the largest radio station in LA at the time in the early 60s. And that was on the AM side. I had an FM side that was country western music, KZLA. So
They listen to country western music in L.A.?
Yeah, they do.
They do.
So anyway, so he ran that operations. My uncle was their chief engineer, and my dad at the time was a cop, LAPD, for 20 years. And then when he, you know, he retired early and took over the radio station when my grandfather got older. So then from there, he saw a television station that was dark and put all new equipment in it and coordinated a syndication deal with a group out of Chicago and started broadcasting the financial news.
Wow.
So that was KWHY Channel 22. And they were one of the first financial news networks on the West Coast.
Wow.
So basically just, you know, they had the ticker tape going all the time in the background.
Oh,
you know,
yeah, there
news
you go.
Shows and everything like that.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So from there, we were in, you know, we lived in the Valley, and then we moved to Newport Beach, where we parents built a house. And, you know, my dad became, was kind of a serial entrepreneur. So anything he saw opportunity in, he took advantage of it. He owned a couple of private boat repair yards, an offshore insurance company, a bank, you know, all sorts of different things.
And then
in 2000, you know, early 2000, you know, 2000, late 90s, 2000, we tried to bring NFL because our relationship with the Cowboys, it was, you know, he had a better relationship with Clint Murchison Jr. because they were the same, pretty much the same age. And we tried to bring the football back into Anaheim because LA didn't have a football team at that point. And then my dad was diagnosed with Alzheimer's and diabetes, and we kind of pulled out of that deal. And and he passed away in 2001.
That was your dad. So Clint Murchison Sr. is obviously the first.
Clint Murchison Sr. was the matriarch.
He was in the oil and gas business.
He was in oil and gas. Yeah. He owned Daisy Manufacturing. He owned Centrex Development.
Right, right.
Then Clint Murchison Jr. came in and took over that.
Okay.
With another partner, and then he was the one that bought the team.
He's the one that brought the team to Dallas.
Yeah.
He bought the team?
He bought the team or brought it to Dallas. I mean, there were some, you know, battles between the Hunt family a little bit. They were the Dallas Texans, and then they were, you know, then when Clint Murchison Jr. took it over, he had to get votes from the other owners. So if you've heard the Rossi and Redson songs that they play in the, you know, on the sidelines, Hail to the Redskins. Well, that was Clint Murchison Jr. owned the rights to that song, and he sold it to the Redskins for $2,000 to get, you know, get them to vote to get him to, you know, allow him to have the
A lot of history there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So wow. Then, you know, he was an oil, you know, and you know that he's an oil and gas wildcatter and, you know, live highs and lows, and he had the lows. And in the early 70s, we actually tried to buy the team from him. My dad did, but he ended up selling it to the Bright family in 78.
Right.
And then the Jones family came in later in the early 90s and late 80s and early 90s, he bought the team.
89 or whatever it was.
So then we were, you know, we're in California. We were, you know, my dad did a number of different things and then passed away. And then my mom and dad had divorced prior to, so it's just, you know, my mother and the four kids, and my mother has kind of an interesting story. She's an Italian American, you know, half Italian, Italian. Her Castellucci was her maiden name.
Hmm.
And her father, my grandfather, immigrated from Northern Italy, Torino, 1906 through Ellis Island, did not know how to read or write, and kind of migrated up to Steubenville, Ohio, where he met my grandmother. And they got married. She was 15, he was 27. They came out west and started a restaurant called Villa Torino's, which was downtown LA. Very mainstream, good Italian food. And one day a guy walks in all dressed to the nines, and my grandfather's in his bar outfit. And he says, "Can I help you?" And he says, "Yeah, my name is Tony Lucy. And I have the restaurant on Melrose across from Paramount Studios. I'm just out here seeing who my competition is." And as they got to talking, they realized they were brothers. They hadn't seen each other in 20 years, because all the kids were all, the parents died in Italy, and the kids, 14 kids, were all separated and lived with different relatives in Italy and Europe.
Oh, wow.
So that's where it was. My grandfather's brother was Tony Castellucci, but he lived with an uncle in Europe named Lucy. So he changed his name to Tony Lucy Castellucci. So,
oh, my gosh.
So then, you know, they rebuilt their relationship. LA Times had an article, a small little paragraph about it. And then, but Tony Lucy didn't like L.A. He hated L.A. So he saw opportunity in Las Vegas and left his wife and packed the restaurant up and bought a majority interest in a saloon casino called the Golden Nugget.
Oh,
1948.
There you go. And ran Golden
that 48. Yeah, wow. Ran that operations for a number of years until he became ill with liver disease. And then when it became terminal, he sold that majority interest to my grandfather.
Hmm.
And my grandfather said, well, I'm too old to run a saloon and a casino. So
in the middle of the desert.
Yeah, so he ended up selling the operating aspect of that to Steve Wynn Sr., who was a slot machine guy out of Florida. And then from there, Steve Wynn Jr. came in and really grew it to, you know, the company it is, you know, it's no longer. It's
Golden Nugget, now, Mirage. Yeah.
But we, you know, we used to go to shareholders meetings and, you know, have dinner with Wynn, and we just kind of rode the wave until it sold to MGM. Then we reinvested back into Wynn, and then it was just my mother and uncle. And then, you know, I was a sports medicine major in college and then didn't really pursue that. I got into finance on the mortgage side. And then when that imploded in 2007, I said, well, why don't I just start investing our money? You know, so there's my mother and the three other siblings. And so we started investing in the smaller kind of structured equity deals. So I coordinated a group with a group out of Century City. And we were kind of, they were debt structured as debt with some equity upside. So they were equity-like returns.
Hmm.
So we'd, you know, $1 to $3 million, we'd come in as kind of a junior debt, and then we'd take a revenue share on, as for our equity. And it's gone well, and we formed a family office. That's where I met Christian, and we charismated back and forth on different deals, and we decided that, yeah, well, why don't we work together on certain things? So, you know, that's how we kind of here today. Yeah.
Wow, that's great. That's great.
Yeah.
I know you guys, you know, in from L.A. today, and I appreciate you guys coming in and being on the Jay Young Show. Man, this place has grown a lot, and we appreciate having you. And
thank you.
We want to learn more about your fund. So right now you're raising money for your third fund.
Correct.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. So how much money are you raising?
It's a $150 million fund.
$150 million. Is that in equity?
Yes.
That'll be $150 million in equity.
Correct.
Would you take one check, or is that from many different investors?
From UJ, yes, we'll make an exception.
So would you do it from many different investors, I guess?
There's really three types of investors that you find when you're raising money. You have high net worth individuals that has always been kind of the, when you're starting out your first fund, that's usually where you're sourcing those types of opportunities from.
Right.
Then you have family offices that are a little bit more organized. And then you have effectively, you know, different types of institutions. And so within institutions, you have like pension funds, you have sovereign wealth funds, you know, you have, you know, mezzanine funds and so forth and so on. And endowment funds. And so the institutions are a little bit more sophisticated. They typically, you know, have an issue where they're looking to invest, you know, a minimum of 10 or 20 million dollars, but they don't want to be over a certain percentage of the fund. And so they typically get involved later, you know, but the first and second funds typically are more proof of concept funds. You know, what is the investment thesis? Does it work out well? And so there's a little bit of higher risk when you're talking about a first and second fund, usually, because there are investment theses that don't necessarily work out. But that's okay for some of the high net worth and family office folks.
So is this third fund, is this a third fund for the same companies that are in the fund?
No. So
these are brand new companies that have never had any financing before.
Yeah. The types of deals that we specifically source are usually off market, what we call enterprise software companies. And so what that means is
enterprise software
companies. Yeah. So what that means is it's basically software companies that sell to bigger businesses, usually Fortune 500. So like JP Morgan, AT&T, Department of Defense, you know, those types of things.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're out looking for those deals, or out looking for those software companies.
Correct.
They may be over in this building, or they could be in this building.
Absolutely. Our focus usually is in North America. So
North America, software companies that have developed some kind of a software to better, you know, talk about accounting, or what are some of your favorite ones? Do you know what's in the fund now?
So we just started our third, you know, fund. Okay. We're identifying prospects right now because we're in the fundraising process currently.
Prospects
to acquire.
okay, to acquire, okay. Mm-hmm. Prospects in looking for capital.
Correct.
Looking for investors and looking for this. So you're correct. Putting the two together.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. All right. So yeah, primarily they're spread across.
How much would
United
you
States.
Invest in one company?
Usually between 10, we write checks between 10 and 15 million.
Okay. So that's 10 to 15 deals,
yeah,
I guess.
Exactly.
So you're looking for 150, you have, raise 150 million, you're going to invest that into 10 or 15 companies.
Correct.
Okay.
Yep.
What if I had a good software company? What would that look like? What would interest you?
So we're usually looking for companies.
I need 10 million. That's why I'm saying it. Oh. I'll have to come up with some kind of a software company. But
well, Jay, usually our companies are selling to, I'll call it, blue chip customers, right? So their end customers are like JP Morgan, like I said, AT&T, the U.S. government.
They're already selling to them.
Yes.
So they already have a. Why do they need money?
Well, usually what happens is these are companies with revenues of 5 to 20 million. And, you know, so they're basically what we call in the lower middle market. So they haven't necessarily got to that point where a lot of traditional, you know, more broadly focused funds would you know, look at them. Because that arena, that feeding frenzy, usually exists when you're over 20 million in revenue, generating 3 to 5 million of EBITDA. But so what we're looking for is these off-market deals that have really, really great technology, have wonderful customer base, really sticky technology, but for whatever reason have stubbed their toe along the way. So, you know, and we come in and we basically help to get them to profitability if they're not profitable already. And we help the front office, you know, get the sales engine cranking. So we get the revenues, you know, growing in an optimal way. And we help them through, you know, that learning curve.
So am I buying equity in the company that you're acquiring?
Yep.
Why would they sell? Is there really a company that would sell equity?
Oh, yeah. In fact, we take control. So we take 51% to 100% equity of these investments.
Wow.
Yeah.
And they're willing to do that, even though they have a good balance sheet or they have a good revenue stream.
So usually they...
And you said stub their toes. I mean, they really stub their toes.
Yeah.
Probably stub both of them.
Usually the balance sheet's not so good, truth be told. Yeah. But it's something where we believe over an investment period of, you know, call it, you know, 2 to 5 years, we believe we can turn it around.
Okay.
Yeah.
So 2 to 5 years of equity will be needed to come in, and maybe not all at one time, but maybe just a gradual, mm-hmm. you know, slew of income. What are some companies, give me some examples of that in the past that you, because this is your third fund, so you've already done this a couple of times. You know, so what are some good examples? What's your best example?
Well, I'd say really two. There was one company that we had in our first fund, you know, that did about $2.5 million in revenue, and was losing about $1 million a year in profits. So, you know, but had really great end customers. That technology was effectively really sticky in the telecommunications space as well as financial services. And what it did was it effectively managed, you know, the complex services within each of those businesses. And so when we came in, you know, this business really didn't have any salespeople at all. You know, didn't really had a very small crew of people, you know, running the back office. We came in, put a back office, we put it in a controller. You know, we put in, you know, the right IT, the right HR. We put in a VP of sales. We put in, solid sales team. And within, you know, 2 years, 3 years, it was a $14 million company with about $2.7 million of EBITDA.
Wow.
So pretty big, you know, turnaround.
Yeah.
But again, really great technology. But one of the issues was that there was no salespeople. So there was no one really kind of, you know, building great relationships with the end customer and understanding how to correlate the business value that this technology could bring, you know, to that end customer and actually map that out.
Yeah.
And so that was a really good example.
So did you go into the company and say, hey, you need more salespeople and mm-hmm. help the whole process that whole process there? I mean,
correct.
Okay. So you're not afraid that if you put a capital, how much money did you put in that company?
So that was a $5 million purchase.
$5 million. Okay. So you, $5 million, you're not afraid to go in and go, okay, well, you're fired, you're good so far, maybe wait till Monday or whatever, and let's add 5 people in sales or whatever. You're not afraid to do that.
Yeah, we have a methodology, basically a playbook, that, if you will, that has different stages. And so the first stage is the acquisition stage, in which case we basically vet out the deal, make sure the technology is really good, it's not very repeatable, it's got 6 sticky customers. Then once we acquire it, right, we go through, you know, acquisition stage into restoration. And in that restoration stage is we repair the back office, we repair the front office with the sales engine cranking, mm-hmm. And then basically we're bringing in the right leadership to take it and take that, have that company be taken to the next level. And typically a founder, if there is a founder, some of the companies we bought actually have no founders anymore, but if there is a founder, usually they're really focused on technology. So they want to be like that CTO type. They don't necessarily want to be the CEO. They don't want to be running sales organizations.
Right, right.
They don't want to be, you know, looking at balance sheets and P&L statements and, you know, going through audits.
Right.
And so that really becomes a good mix. So we like to think of it as a financial partnership, whereby we've gone through this process before multiple times. But at the end of the day, there's a lot of value that's created, you know, for even that founder who might be taking less in percentage, but it's a smaller piece of a bigger pie that we've systemically been able to prove.
Okay. Okay. Great. Great. You said there was two.
Oh, yeah.
There was two different ones, or there's no.
So the second one was a company that did about about $5 million of revenue in the first year. We acquired in 2016, and ultimately, again, it's one of these companies that had really has really great technology, just was not being very well run on the back office. Again, it was losing about $1 million worth of EBITDA, but they only had one salesperson. But they had, you know, 40 or 50.
Pretty good, 5 million. I mean, one salesperson for 5 million.
And the problem, Jay, that you get into is that these customers are not small customers, right? You're talking about Fortune 500 companies, right? So yeah. They're $1 billion or certainly even higher than that, $1 billion of revenue or higher, right? So right. You've got a lot of people inside of each of these organizations. So having even just one salesperson for one account is difficult to really provide the right service, because at the end of the day, you have great technology, but getting that word out there for that customer about how they can use that technology in various different ways of your day-to-day business is really important. And so in that example, in this one example, even though they had 40 or 50, you know, Fortune 500 companies, having one sales rep really is a discredit, you know, to that company. They really needed growth capital to take it to the next level with proven, you know, leadership, you know, around, you know, hiring the right salespeople that could ultimately manage, you know, a good book of business.
Yeah.
And that's what we did.
Wow. How many people did y'all increase the number of salespeople?
Oh, yeah. So we went from one salesperson to it's about a dozen today.
Dozen today.
Yeah.
What are your sales now?
So right now, it's basically this coming year should do about $13 million
wow.
of revenue.
Yeah. Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah,
good for
thank you.
So what, so you're raising, how much money did you raise in the first couple of funds?
So our first two funds were very small.
Okay.
So, you know, most of it was, you know, family office money, you know, but first fund was $10 million and second fund was $32
million. Wow.
But they were short funds. So, first two funds were only 5-year funds. So okay. That's 5 years to find an investment, to buy it, to turn it around, to grow it, and then ultimately sell it.
Mm.
And so one of the things that we're doing with our third fund is effectively we extended that to be a 10-year fund.
Okay.
You know, where we're expecting profits to come out in the year three, but ultimately speaking, you know, gives us an extra, you know, some extra time to really see the value, you know, created.
Gotcha. Are you going to raise $150 million just right off the bat? Or how long will it take you to raise $150 million?
That typically takes about a year to fundraise. Every fund is different, but typically it takes a year. You know, you've got much, you know, very mature, you know, companies like private equity companies like Blackstone that will raise things in literally, you know, weeks. You know, but they manage very, very large, you know, funds and so forth. And then you've got, you know, obviously the smaller guys, but typically it takes about a year to raise a fund.
Okay. What if I come in today with $100,000 and go, okay, here you go, here's $100,000. Will you put me in the first company you buy, or will I own a part of all of them?
No, you own a part of all of them.
Part of all of them.
Yeah, so the way it works
is... So I should wait until the very last check.
Well, there's actually some economics that incent people to be
early. Do that? What do? You give better deal or better...
There's an incentive, yes.
Incentive, okay,
yeah.
All right, good. All right, good. So... you're looking to raise $150 million.
Mm-hmm.
We have your website up there on the deal. We want to make sure that we give a good shout out for their fund, and want to make sure that people that know where to call you, how to get a hold of. I'm sure that you are web based and
absolutely.
You got a big website and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, even the Murchison family can see mm-hmm. all that stuff. So, is this how you got involved? Is this something that you did yourself before?
Well, we were doing more kind of debt
You're doing 1 to 3 million. What was that again?
Kind of. It was more. We call it kind of a structured equity. It's really in the private equity space, but we were looking at companies that were kind of at an inflection of growth, run by the kind of founders of the company, and we're the first institutional capital that they see. So they can't get a debt piece from a bank. They've already kind of maxed out their line of credit with their bank, so they need more capital to really grow.
Right.
And we provide that growth capital. So usually the company's got positive EBITDA between $1 and $2 million. And that capital that we provide really steps them up in growth.
Right.
So we're getting usually, like I'll give you an example. So a year and a half ago, we did a metal fabricator out of Florida. And we actually helped the CEO buy the company from the family. So you know, he's going to take it, put his whole team in it, really institutionalize that. They make parts for big industrial grinders and shredders. They make bed liners for mining dump trucks and conveyor belts. And, you know, they got a plasma laser that'll cut a 50-foot, you know, sheet of steel.
Wow.
You know. So we helped them. What we did was structured in $2 million into that deal. And we structured as a 10% fully amortized note for 5 years. And then we get a 2.5% revenue share on top line revenues.
Okay.
So where I...
A little royalty there. Little Murchison royalty.
Right. So we've done, you know, I think 8 deals, and they've all been between 3 to 6 times our initial capital investment. So it's gone well. Got some smart partners.
Now, how do you learn how to do all these deals? I love this. This sounds really interesting and all these different...
Well, I wanted to add that, if you don't mind, on the Fund 3, his fund, we're going to take that strategy on a certain percentage and look at some credit opportunities in the enterprise software space.
Okay.
And add some octane to the overall fund strategy, too. So,
yeah.
Yeah, when we got through our second fund, you know, Dennis gave me a call, and we had been investing together for quite some time, known each other since 2012, you know, we thought it would be a great opportunity to kind of partner together to kind of bring, you know, not only the next level of the enterprise software investment thesis that we've been doing with Lotus, mm-hmm. but also, you know, Dennis's strategy as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's great.
And then on deal flow, we have no lack of real deal flow. I mean, you know, we get people calling us all the time. We know, could you look at this deal? In fact, look at this deal. And then we decided to kind of form a multifamily office consortium to kind of look at, you know.
Multifamily office.
Yeah, so look at these deals and maybe underwrite them and say, hey, that might make sense. Let's push it out to different guys that we know that have their own family office and see if we can get a syndicate together to help fund these deals.
Yeah, for deals that are outside of our investment thesis.
Yeah, that we don't.
You know, real estate deals, oil and gas, that sort of thing.
So, what kind of schooling would you recommend somebody to go to learn how to look at deals and structure deals and all that? What's a good? We have BBA, MBA. There's some really sharp people in the MBA.
Sure.
Would you say business school?
Oh yeah, business.
Finance.
Yeah, in the private equity world, you know, the majority of people, you know, get their MBAs. I would say that the typical career path is, you know, you get some sort of, you know, science, mathematics, engineering, you know, types of background. You graduate with that degree, maybe intern, you know, at a private equity, you know, company, you know, while you're going through getting your bachelor's degree. Ultimately, you graduate. You know, maybe become an associate at a private equity, you know, company, do really well, start to see a lot of different deals, because at the end of the day, you know, school is going to be great, you know, but you're not going to be able to get that practical experience until you actually start seeing deal flow and seeing how they're particularly underwritten as they, you know, get analyzed, you know, by a, you know, private equity fund. And then you typically get to senior associate. And then you effectively go off and get your MBA and then come back and become a principal within a private equity fund, and then, you know, you can go up the ladder to partner from there. So that's typically how it works.
Mm-hmm.
Now, our background is certainly more on the operator side, being successful at, you know, finding either investments or growing companies, and then kind of going into, you know, this on our own. So we have a little bit different background, but I think that gives us an advantage because we can kind of roll up our sleeves and get dirty.
Well, that's another way you can start a fund is be. Have a company, it's really successful. Sell that company, and say, "Hey, I can do this for other companies." Put your own capital into forming a fund, raise the additional capital in that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that's interesting.
Me, on the other hand, I went to the School of Hard Knocks because I was a sports medicine major in college. So I Christian sprains his ankle.
Hey, so tell me a good Cowboy story. Is there a lot of Cowboy fans out there? They won last weekend, and you were there.
Right.
At the game.
Yeah, I was at the game. Yeah.
That's awesome. And so tell me one of your favorite pass. I mean, I you look like Clint Murchison with the glasses. I don't know. Yeah. I need some glasses like that. But that's Clint Murchison looking goggles you got on there. I like them. Tell me a good Cowboy. What's your favorite Cowboy story?
Well, my favorite Cowboy story was they come out to California every summer and used to train at Cal Lutheran, and then they moved that to Oxnard. And when they were at Cal Lutheran, we'd go out and see the team and, you know, hang out with, my dad was buddies with Tom Landry and Tex Stram, and, you know, I was a kid, so we'd go out and see the team, watch them practice. And, you know, those were always good times. I mean, I remember a friend of mine was so excited in high school to go see because I invited him to go see the team, and he's all excited, he's ready, raring to go, and then he slipped in the bathtub and broke his ribs, so he couldn't go out to see the team. So, you know, it was unfortunate, but I got him a hat anyway. So, you know, there was another time when we saw the team in Oxnard, and my dad has since passed away, and my friend, another friend I bought a Cowboy hat of his son's, and, you know, Lasorda was there visiting, you know, the training camp at the time, and then Jerry Jones pulls up and he once has Lasorda's book. He goes, "Oh, I want you to get this, you to sign this. I want you to sign it." And so, while Lasorda was signing his book, my friend got Jerry to sign his hat. So, but those are some interesting stories.
Yeah.
And then my dad did he was part of a nonprofit in Grand Rapids called Gospel Films, which is now called Gospel Communications. And he sat on that board with Richard DeVos, who owned Amway Corporation, formed Amway. And they did a film on Tom Landry called A Man and His Men.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And I gave a copy of it to the PR director over at the Cowboys.
You know, is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, Tom was a great, great guy.
Yeah.
Legend. I mean, obviously legendary. I mean, he's a great guy.
And then the only last story, it's not really a Cowboy story, but a friend of ours in California, his name was Raj Bathal, and he built a bathing suit manufacturer with him and his wife from the ground up, and he wanted to buy into a sports franchise. And when they had this World League of American Football, he called me and said, "Hey, do you think your dad could take us out to meet Tom Landry and Tex Stram? And we're looking at we might have to buy the San Antonio, get involved." So they flew out, and Raj, I mean, he always talks about, this is a guy that now he owns a part of the Sacramento Kings, but he always talks about flying out to Dallas to meet Tom Landry and Tex Stram and looking at this team.
Well, yeah, something to do with that. That was awesome. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great. So tell me what I would be looking at if I made a million-dollar investment, 200,000. I mean, would you take 50 grand, 100,000, 200,000? What is your minimum on your fund?
So our minimum is a million-dollar commitment.
Million-dollar commitment.
Right.
Commitment, not all up front.
No.
Okay.
Typically what we do is every year we pull down about 20% of that commitment.
Okay.
So in this particular case, it would be 200,000.
Okay.
In fund one, fund two, we've traditionally only pulled down, you know, anywhere from 50, you know, to 70% of the fund in the past.
Okay.
Not to say that we wouldn't do 100% in fund three, but our whole goal is to basically try to generate enough profits as soon as possible. We're projecting profits to be dispersed around year three or later. Granted, you know, it could be longer than that. But ultimately speaking, as we create a lot of value, create a lot of profits,
I'm committing a million, but I don't necessarily have to come up with a million. I
correct.
May not have to, because you're going to, it's 200,000, no more than 20% a year, I'm assuming that's kind
correct.
Of a goal. So then I would have to come up with $200,000 this year, the next year, then you may sell a business over here. So I don't have to come up with another $100,000 or $200,000. I may get a ride on that. So even though I've got a bigger commitment, I may not have to come up with that money.
Yeah, that's our goal. I mean, generate a lot, as much cash as early as possible.
Yeah.
You know, so that our partners don't necessarily have to write all all those checks, and ultimately everyone likes to get the disbursements.
So. Right. So all the money goes into the account when you're calling for it. You call for it and you say, okay, we're buying XYZ company, so we're going to call for the cash. And then you call for it, comes in, then it goes back out to the company that you're buying, or equity notes or whatever, however you're buying that company. And then how long? So it'll be about another 2 years, 3 years, or four. So you get revenue from the company? Would you normally get revenue from the company, or would you normally just...
It's not so much revenue as it is, we have two different types of turnaround teams. We have a front office turnaround team, as I mentioned, that's focused on getting that sales engine cranking so revenue goes in the right way. But then we also have a back office turnaround team that focuses on getting a company to profitability within the first year of acquisition. Okay. And so the goal is that if we can grow revenues at 20% plus, per year, and we can get the companies to be 20% profitable or more per year, then we're able to generate dividends effectively from those assets into the fund. And then from there, we can distribute it out to our partners.
Yeah. Okay.
And then ultimately, when we sell it, obviously, that money comes back to the fund too.
Right. Okay. So let me ask one more question. What does your office look like? Do you have an office anywhere in California?
We do.
What does your team look like? Your executive team, I guess.
So we have about six people within our executive team. We call them the general partners of the fund itself. And then we have those back office, front office teams that I was telling you about. And that's about 13 people in addition to the six people that we have within the general partnership.
Okay. So GPs, the six executive team members, are they people that are well-versed in accounting or marketing? Or is there one accounting person, one marketing person, one?
Great question. So effectively, the way we've kind of divvied up the roles and responsibilities are there's deal sourcing, which is finding the deals that are out there. Because we like to find off-market deals. Because a lot of the companies that we invest in, because they're relatively small. I mean, they're not pre-revenue, right? Again, 5 to 20 million in revenues, but they're just not on any particular market usually. So we have deal sourcing, then we have investor relations, which is important for making sure to manage things on a day-to-day basis and ensuring everyone's got their K-1s and their statements and all that good stuff. And, answering any kind of questions that people might have. Okay. Then you've got fund operations, making sure that, as we go through the different stages of the acquisitions, that, things are on track and we're kind of managing, the assets that are underneath, or we're involved in any particular area that we need. And there's other areas too, that we have business development and so forth.
Well, that's great. What great minds that you have to bring together because you're buying two, three deals a year?
Yeah, about two.
About two deals a year.
Right.
So you're looking at how many deals to buy two?
I would say for every one deal we do, we look at about 100.
Oh my gosh, that's a lot of deals.
Now, the first 50, 60, they're easy to cross off the list.
Yeah.
It gets down to 30 or 40, a little bit more due diligence is implied. And then we have an investment committee that is comprised of, the six folks that are on our team.
Right.
And the nice thing about our six folks is even though they might have different backgrounds, like for instance, Dennis has great, background in the credit realm and all stuff. He's also got a lot of enterprise software experience. And so one of the things that's really important for us, because our investment thesis is so focused on enterprise software and so focused in enterprise software in the lower middle market, right, that smaller company, we're able to come at it from, different experience levels as we evaluate deals. And so, 100 will boil down to ultimately 10. We take a really solid look at 10 after, that's usually when we start, talking about offers and so forth. And then that 10 will ultimately turn into one through negotiations and things of that nature.
Okay. All right. Good. Well, I kind of wish we were live so we could ask questions, or people could come in and ask questions. I'm trying to ask as many questions as I think that, because we go through this and a fellow Tiger member, Christian, is out of
Newport Beach.
Yeah, and I was thinking south of L.A. And I was thinking about all the different deals, because I've been a member for 10 years and I've been in 100 meetings, I guess, or 200 meetings. I mean, I've been to a lot. I went to one or two, two or three a month sometimes.
Sure.
If I'm traveling, to New York or San Francisco, L.A., I've been to Newport Beach. Great meetings out there. Well, there's some really big money people, man. Yeah. And but neat people. And just thinking about all the different questions, because you'll have we'll have one or two different investment opportunities every time we have a Tiger meeting. And then when they come in, there's always the list of questions. You know, so what do you do? How much money are you making? Where'd you get your money? You know, the ones, and that's what I was trying to ask and trying to think of the same thing, you know, about. So the fund, one question I didn't ask, and so how do you make money? You're putting the deal together. How do you make, are you doing this for free for all your investors or?
So there's two ways that we make money. You know, first of all, the general partnership has committed a significant size of commitment to the fund itself. It's not insignificant whatsoever. It's more than 10%.
You're investing in the fund itself.
Correct.
You have skin in the game.
Oh yeah, very much so.
Is that important?
Oh, absolutely. I think so. It aligns interests. It does.
Yeah.
But then we also, we charge a 2% management fee.
Okay.
On the fund too, and that kind of keeps the lights on, you know, both from a general partner basis as well as those turnaround teams.
So 2% of the capital that you call for, or is that 2%? So if I call for, if you sell 150 million, you find 150 guys out there that got $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be hard to do, but man, I'd love your list if you did. But if you found 150 million, would you do 2% on the 150 million? So, every year, or would it just be the capital that you called for?
So it's the first 5 years is based on the commitment, and then the last 5 years is based on the invested capital.
Okay.
Yeah.
First 5 years is committed. It's on what again? First 5 years is on the
committed capital.
Committed. Okay.
So 150 in that particular case.
If I call for $20 million this year,
mm-hmm.
this year I'm calling for 2%. So you guys have $400,000 worth of.
So if we were able to raise 150 million, which is our target,
uh-huh.
at the minimum, 150 million, then we basically, you know, charge 2% on that 150. So it's $3 million.
Okay.
Per year for the first 5 years.
Okay.
And then it flips into, okay, how much capital has actually been pulled down,
okay.
you know, versus in that time period. And then that's 2% of that number. So let's just say, you know, we only pull down, you know, 60%, you know, in that 5 year period. You know, then it'll be 2% of that $90 million that was pulled down ultimately.
Okay.
You know?
Wow, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money for you guys. I mean, I know it costs money to live, especially in California. You know?
Well, we have the 6 people inside the general partnership, and then we have the 13 people, you know, that are turning things around on a day-to-day basis. But that's the first way. And then ultimately speaking, as we sell our assets, then we get 20% of what we call the carry, which is, you know, after everyone gets their capital back, they are also offered a 8% preferred return. So whatever money has been pulled down, they immediately get that 8% on the pull down capital that continues to build. So the waterfall, as we like to call it, is, you know, you get your capital back, then you get your preferred return, whatever that number is. And, you know, that's obviously based on how long, you know, that investment or how long that capital has been pulled down. But after that, kind of the third level is any kind of profits. And those profits are split 80% to our investors, and then 20% goes to the general partnership.
Okay. Wow, that's great. That's great. Okay. Well, that's good. That's a typical 220 deal. You know, it's good. So that's great. That's great. So now we learned a lot about deals, structuring deals, and how do companies out there, you're thinking about all these different companies are out there that everybody's just an entrepreneur that has plenty of money, but man, there are a lot of companies out there that are underfunded.
Oh yeah.
You know, that need that extra little boost.
It's kind of interesting because in 2014, when we started Lotus, our focus was within specific segments within enterprise software. So enterprise software, right? It's any technology that effectively is sold to other businesses to help that business run. Well, that market can be broken into many, many different segments, but there are 9 specific segments that we really like. The reason why we like them is because during the dot-com implosion back in, you know, early 2000, 2001, and during the Great Recession, we noticed that there were particular segments that did, you know, ironically very well during those times.
Mm.
And that was because, you know, you have these Fortune 500 companies that when they hit a recession, you know, they had to figure out how to provide the same service with less people, unfortunately.
Wow.
And in this particular case, thanks to COVID, it's less people and a remote workforce.
Oh, my gosh.
So the only way to do that is by investing in software to help drive automation.
Okay.
So you've got particular segments like automation is a great, you know, to drive efficiency. So you've got like automation, the automation segment, which is great. Security, obviously, with everyone working remote, you know, there's a lot of focus on how do you how do you secure, a remote workforce? You've got collaboration, things like Zoom and so forth, obviously that have grown like crazy. And there's six other areas that we specifically focus in on. And the reason why I bring this up is because these areas are, I won't call them recession-proof, but they're recession resilient. They do quite well. And we've back-tested this, during these times, like the dot-com implosion and the Great Recession, such that these markets do well during regular times, but they do typically extremely well during downtimes. And so, but the interesting part about this is that you still have companies out there that have really great technology that might even be focused in on this space that for whatever reason just were not run profitably. Mm. And they thought that the bull market would last forever, and obviously it didn't. And so they hit this glass wall, and there's not a lot of creditors out there, looking to extend credit on an unprofitable business, even though it might be growing. Right. And so for us, the opportunity that we found is that this is a great opportunity. It's like a perfect storm of opportunity, because now we've got growing companies that are aligned in this segment. But they have to get access to capital, because they have to figure out how to effectively reverse the unprofitable trend that they've started. So the way they do that is through Lotus, through us.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's awesome. Well, that's great, guys. Well, I'll tell you what, Kristen, great for you to be here. Dennis, great for you to be here. I appreciate both of you. You put a lot in. Is there anything in particular? If there was one thing that you had to say, and I put this on my Forbes advisor book or whatever it was, if there's one thing you wanted to tell somebody that was young and that wanted to really, what's the best advice you ever got?
I would say that hard work and hustling is the most important things, because you just never know where life's going to take you. But one thing's for sure, persistence through hard work and just kind of, ultimately that grit is super important.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, I think persistence and meet people. Mm-hmm. It's important to be networked.
Yeah,
because if you went, a lot of the high net worth people that or the family offices we meet, they know everybody.
Yep.
Yeah. And they can pick up a phone and call anybody.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. You're never going to be the smartest guy in the room.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but you can meet.
That for.
Yeah.
No, it's true. I mean, that's great. And I tell you, just being positive. I found myself, this business may be not going the right way. Yeah. Look at Ellen DeGeneres. I mean, she came out and she says, I am a person. I get in a bad mood. I've got to carry myself. I've got to, all this kind of stuff, which is, true. Everybody can't be perfect.
Right.
Mm. And I think it's never, ever give up.
Absolutely.
Because it's hard. And I know there's a lot of people out there that think that, look at this guy. He's got a nice suit on. He sold his business, and it just happened overnight. Man, it was a lot of late nights and weekends and a lot of things that people don't really see. That when you're driving up in a car, you're flying on a jet, or you're doing whatever. I mean, it was a lot of hard work that you put in, with some success and with some luck, and with things your way, that help you get there. So
absolutely,
it's positive and it's never giving up, and some of the things that y'all says. So thank you guys so much for being on.
Thank you.
Want to have you back sometime.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Great. Absolutely.
Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Thank you. All right, guys. Hey, thank you very much for coming in today. Jay Young Show, man, what a couple of great guys we got today, learning from them and understanding more about what it is to be an entrepreneur, but also, man, what can you learn from these guys and the pathway of success? So thank you very much. Everybody have a great week, and we'll talk to you next week. Thank you.